This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 30 years ago this week, the Endangered Species Act became law. Last week, we explored its genesis and its evolution. Today, we'll focus on a few stories to illustrate how this law can affect various species and people. Not every animal is as beloved as the bald eagle, nor as controversial as the spotted owl. Why is it easier to save some animals and not others? What role can private property owners and industry play that's good for business and good for animals? Are the wildlife protections of the Endangered Species Act an issue where you live? Does it affect how you do business or the quality of your life? Give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin with one of the legacies of success. Some describe the reintroduction of the gray wolf into the Rocky Mountain areas as a triumph. Many who live near Yellowstone Park say the wolves are a major problem and that the law infringes their rights. Joining us now from his office in Missoula, Montana, is Tom France, director and counsel for the National Wildlife Federation's Northern Rockies office, and it's good of you to join us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Neil.
How many wolves were there in the Rockies 30 years ago? How many are there today?
On the U.S. side of the Canadian-U.S. border 30 years ago, there were no wolves. They'd been exterminated through a predator control campaign that ran through the first half of the last century.
And how many are there now?
Today we have well over 600 wolves in the three states of Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming.
And is that considered a success?
I think most wildlife advocates and most Americans consider it one of the great success stories of the Endangered Species Act, in that we really developed a very balanced restoration program that has produced good wildlife management and a fair result for those that are affected by wolves.
Is it so successful that the gray wolf can now be safely downlisted?
Well, downlisting and delisting are controversial subjects, but certainly it's a conversation that we should be having. We've hit the population targets that have been set, and it's really a question of how and not whether they should be taken off the endangered species list.
Joining us now from his home in Big Piney, Wyoming, is Jim Urbikite. He's a sheep rancher and among those who filed lawsuits opposing the reintroduction of the gray wolf in Yellowstone. And Mr. Urbikite, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Now, you opposed reintroduction. It's gone ahead. What kind of experience has it been for you in Big Piney?
With the reintroduction, the impact on our sheep operation is just the increased time and worry in trying to protect the sheep from wolves.
And are wolves taking sheep?
Not on our ranch. They haven't yet.
Are they elsewhere?
Yes.
And this is obviously a financial loss to those who suffer that kind of thing. Are there concerns about wolves coming down into populated areas?
Well, the reintroduced wolves are a population of habituated wolves. They were held in pens in Yellowstone Park and fed by people before they were released, and they became very used to people. They were released into Yellowstone Park. There's no threat to them from people there. So as wolves have expanded their outside Yellowstone Park into the adjacent areas and states, these wolves are habituated wolves without a natural fear of humans that wild wolves should have. So, yeah, they are not adverse to coming close to settlements, homes, towns, cities, rural subdivisions.
And as I understand it, if you see a wolf on your property, your ability to interfere in that situation is very limited.
It is. Currently, the Fish and Wildlife's position is a stockman can shoot a wolf or kill a wolf if it is in the act of attacking the livestock. You may not shoot the wolf before it attacks your livestock. You could also shoot a wolf if you could claim it was a threat to human safety, if it was so unafraid of people that you believe that it, an attack on a human was likely. Other than that, you're not allowed to harm these wolves.
Tom France, obviously, as the wolf reintroduction succeeds, there are going to be more interactions with people.
Yeah, everyone acknowledged that there would be livestock occasionally taken by wolves as part of the reintroduction program, but it's very important to keep a perspective on that. There are 400,000 head of cattle and 500,000 head of sheep in wolf range in the Northern Rockies. Last year, there were 40 head of cattle and 200 head of sheep taken. So a very, very small percentage of the livestock ever see a wolf, much less have a problem with them. Defenders of Wildlife has set up a compensation program for landowners and stockmen that lose livestock. The regulations have been steadily loosened as the wolf program has proven successful, and there will be more of that in the future as wolf populations continue to grow and we continue to move towards state assumption of management.
And if, as you say, it is a question of time when the wolf is downlisted or delisted, then presumably people like ranchers could take more direct action if they saw a wolf on their property.
Well, I think the expectation is that ranchers will be given more flexibility, but certainly the states will be managing to maintain recovered populations, and I think everyone is, the large majority of people, Mr. Herbekite perhaps accepted, are in agreement that we want healthy wolf populations in the Northern Rockies.
What's your biggest problem with it, Mr. Herbekite?
Well, I have a lot of problems with the discussion just carried on. It's arrogant of Tom France to suggest that he can understand what would be a minor impact to any stock grower from the presence of wolves. It can be much more than the take of livestock. It can be the huge amount of work that's required to protect your livestock from wolves, even though you may not be losing them. And this is something ranchers aren't compensated for. The idea that any rancher wants compensation for livestock killed by wolves doesn't agree with anybody I know. Ranchers want the right to protect their livestock from wolves. They don't want compensated for livestock that have been torn apart by wolves.
Let's get a caller in on the conversation. This is Brenda, who's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a comment. I can understand both sides of this story. As a rancher, I would think that part of doing business would be that you would factor in that cost into your cost. And as a consumer, I would be willing to pay for that because I really don't believe that as a part of the ecosystem, being man, that we have a right to come in and just assume that we have the rights to wipe out some other species because we want that particular place. The wolves were here first, as were most of the animals in these wild areas. And when if I were to move into one of those areas, that would be one of the environmental factors that I would take into consideration, just like if there were a mountain or there were trees. I would need to take that into consideration. I wouldn't go in and obliterate a mountain because it was convenient for me or it made things easier, and I wouldn't go in and obliterate a stream or a river. Wolves are just as much, and other animals are just as much a part of the ecosystem as those particular pieces.
I think, Brenda, at this point, after the wolf has been reintroduced, they're talking about management. It's no longer a question about extinction.
Right, and I think that at that point that we need to be willing as consumers to have that cost factored into what we pay for our food.
Mr. Herbekite, is there any way for you to do that?
That's not a relevant issue here. The situation that we face here as ranchers is that we accept wildlife here in Wyoming because we love wildlife also. And for my situation, I was a party to a lawsuit trying to protect a native subspecies of wolf that was not extinct at the time of the reintroduction. This reintroduction, from the point of view of a lot of people in Wyoming, is an illegal action on the part of the federal government that is causing the extinction of our native subspecies of wolf. This illegal action is being managed so that it causes maximum harm to stock producers. The caller is exactly right. We need to balance what we have here, and the wolves should be just equally welcome as stock growers. But that's not what we have. The wolves have a priority over stock growers.
Tom France?
Well, the court case that Mr. Herbekite refers to held against him, and we know we didn't have any wolves here until wolves were reintroduced in 1995. I think the program has been about adjusting it and modifying it, listening to ranchers. Certainly the National Wildlife Federation has supported adjusting and changing the program in response to concerns like some that Mr. Herbekite has requested. I think it's important to recognize that millions of Americans have really thrilled at this recovery effort. Yellowstone Park and other places in the Northern Rockies are now some of the best places in the world to see wolves in the environment. We know that wolves are really benefiting big game herds by making them healthier, by restoring natural predator-prey relationships. And while I don't want to suggest that livestock wolf problems aren't real and don't need to be dealt with, I think they're only a small part of the success story that wolf restoration has brought to this part of the country.
Mr. Herbekite, we will register your disagreement with that point.
I would like to add one thing. There was a wolf videotaped in Yellowstone Park the year before the reintroduction, and there was a wolf shot south of Yellowstone Park out of a pack of five the year before the reintroduction. The claim that wolves were not there before the reintroduction is dishonest.
But clearly it didn't convince the federal court, sir.
The federal courts didn't dispute that. The federal courts ruled that the subspecies was protected as a matter of discretion on the part of the Secretary of Interior.
Okay.
Whether or not they were there was not a part of the appeals court ruling.
Thank you very much for participating in our discussion today.
Yes.
Obviously, this is an issue to which we'll return. Brenda, thanks very much for the phone call.
You're welcome.
And that was Jim Urbikite, who was a sheep rancher, who was one of those who filed a lawsuit against the reintroduction of the gray wolf to Wyoming. Tom France, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Tom France is director and counsel for National Wildlife Federation's Northern Rockies office. He was on the line with us from Missoula, Montana. Here with us in the cozier surroundings of Studio 3A in Washington, D.C., is NPR's environment correspondent, John Nielsen. And John Nielsen, I think that a lot of people involved in campaigns for various kinds of animals would be delighted to have a conversation about, you know, the problems engendered by success of maybe having too many.
Yes, that's definitely true. And thank you for not asking me who's right in the discussion that we just heard. The reintroduced predators are, for obvious reasons, the hardest to deal with. There are on top of that, there was a point made, and I don't know to what extent wolves actually are acting this way, the reintroduced wolves, but there is a very interesting thing going on with animals reintroduced that were either kept in parks, in cages, or bred in zoos. A lot of them, there's a long adjustment period. I mean, to kind of put it simply, they don't know quite what to do to be what they are.
Mm-hmm. So like most of us, after being in confinement for a little while or treated differently, we're not quite sure how to get back to our instincts. How typical is the gray wolf story, though? You know, not necessarily the problems emerging from it, but its success from the Endangered Species Act.
Well, there are more endangered... I just was out in Maryland looking at some of the original species on the original list of endangered species, and it's been said that if you break that list down, you get a good sense of what the percentages are in terms of what has worked and what hasn't worked. And generally speaking, there are more species that are better off now than there were 30 years ago. There's a fair number that are, and by better off, I mean no longer in decline or improving. There's a fair number who are declining, and there are a few that are either extinct or going extinct. I mean, you can pick an example of anything you want when you're talking about this law, which is one of the reasons debates are so hard to conduct in a rational way.
And one of the legacies of the law has been, well, a lot of litigation. Most of the decisions on the Endangered Species Act seem to be made by court orders these days. Isn't that right, John?
Well, yeah, but almost all of the litigation concerns one thing, and that is a provision in the Endangered Species Act called the critical habitat provision, which is very controversial. There are some environmentalists who think that it could be reworked in ways that would make it much more effective. And for a long time, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service basically didn't implement it, and there was an environmental group that figured that out and has gone to court dozens of times to force them to implement it, and has won in every case. So, in a way, the suggestion that this thing is all tied up in court because nothing works is a little misleading.
When we come back from a short break, we're going to be discussing the examples that other animals and plants provide us into how the Endangered Species Act works, and we'd like to hear from you. How is it working where you live? We obviously heard how it plays out as an issue involving the gray wolves in Wyoming. Is there a controversy over the Endangered Species Act where you live? How is it affecting your quality of life after 30 years as part of the United States law? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Cohn, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the Endangered Species Act and some creative ways that the ESA has been used. You're invited to join our discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And in the studio with us is NPR's environment correspondent, John Nielsen. And let's take a call from Bob, who's with us from Lake Barkley, Kentucky. Hello, Bob? Bob's apparently not there, so let's go with... Bob, you're there.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I thought I hung up on you, but my imbecility worked in your favor this one time. Go ahead.
Yes, I live in on Lake Barkley in Kentucky Lake in western Kentucky, and shorebirds, of course, are protected. 30 years ago when I first started coming to this area, we had no cormorants, a few blue herons, a couple of egrets. Now we have large quantities of both. Land between the lakes is has been a reintroduction area for bald eagles. But now we are out of frogs. The frogs are gone. We have large populations of mosquitoes that we never had before. And the biologists say it's a result that the shorebirds have eaten the frogs, and the frogs are no longer around to take care of the mosquitoes.
Well, John Nielsen, certainly when you reintroduce a new species or reintroduce species, you can have some unintended effects.
Well, I have to say I don't know the local situation, and so you have to assume that the local guy knows more than I do, but frogs is a discussion that can carry you long into the night, what has caused frogs to decline. In other parts of the country, people have talked about everything from, you know, the thinning of the Earth's protective ozone layer to a virus that has killed massive numbers of species. But I, when you talk about more mosquitoes, one of the little flags that goes up over the top of my head, not literally, is...
you should have seen it. It was red, white, and blue.
Boing, boing. No, it's the invasive species flag. And it's been said that perhaps the most difficult threat to endangered species in this country is exotic species, alien species. Mosquitoes reminded me of that because West Nile is one of those species at a very small level.
Zebra mussels.
There are plants that grow a foot a day in the Florida Everglades, and there are wild boars running up and down the state of California that eat endangered species eggs. And you may have that kind of a situation going there. It's hard to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, generally.
Right. Our proliferation of shorebirds continues to increase. 2 years ago, we began to see pelicans on the lake. Now, you can believe pelicans in West Kentucky. Something is amiss, and these shorebirds are clearly out of control. Seagulls are here in the wintertime in the thousands. They come here to winter, I guess.
I don't know why they're doing that. It sounds pretty good to me, though, but I'm at a distance. I love pelicans.
You don't have to clean up the mess.
True.
Well, Bob, happy shoveling.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now I can't hang up on Bob. What's with my thingy today? There we go. And here's Sandra, and Sandra's with us from Detroit.
Hello. I was kind of wondering how the peregrine falcons are doing in southeastern Michigan. Do you have any...
John?
If they're on the endangered species list or anything?
The peregrine falcon is one of the great success stories. I don't really, again, know the southeastern Michigan situation, but if it's like everywhere else, they were on the verge of extinction 30 years ago because of the widespread use of a pesticide called DDT, which destroyed their eggshells, basically. DDT was banned in 1972, and as it basically disappeared from the environment, the peregrine, with a lot of help from a group called the Peregrine Fund in Idaho, has made a stunning comeback. And one of the reasons that they've been able to do this is they like urban settings as well as rural settings. There are a number of cities with peregrines on tops of tall buildings.
And pigeons are their pigeons.
Yes, okay. They are.
Sandra, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
The California red-legged frog is a threatened species as defined by the Endangered Species Act. The Robert Mondavi Wine Company has found a way to keep its grapes growing and help protect the red-legged frog. Joining us now to tell us more is Robert Levine. He's Director of Grower Relations with Robert Mondavi, and he's with us from his office in San Luis Obispo, California. I hope everything went all right with the earthquake out there.
Yeah, we did fine out here. Of course, we did fine.
When you got hired by Robert Mondavi, did you expect to become an expert in the red-legged frog-saving business?
I didn't have a clue that was going to be what I was going to be doing. Of course, I went to work for him to try and grow the best grapes in the world and make great wine.
And how has it changed your life?
Well, it definitely has had an impact on the farming challenges we have out there. We by our nature, by the nature of the company, we've always been in concerned about environmental issues in the vineyard. So when we started planting vineyards at Cuesta Ridge, we already had a style about us that included protecting oak trees and preserving wetlands, those sorts of things. So that was already part of our way. But when you face endangered species or threatened species, it raises the level of concern. It's an additional business risk you got to think about. Of course, incidental take of an endangered species is a felony, and you know we don't do felonies here. So we had to think about how we were going to deal with it. We had already begun to rehabilitate the habitat along the little creek where the frog lives, because that was just something we would have done normally as part and parcel of planting our vineyards. But when our biologist told us that process of rehabilitation was likely to bring along a threatened species, we needed to think about the next step. And the obvious next step was to continue to do the rehabilitation we were doing, but to find some way to protect ourselves from the downside of having threatened species, which is to get to strike a deal with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service so that if we accidentally killed one, we were protected, but at the same time, we would promise to do and continue the rehabilitation of the habitat.
So let me get this straight. You were rehabilitating this habitat knowing that it might attract these red-legged frogs, and that if they came, the feds would soon follow.
That's right. We really were rehabilitating because we knew it was the right thing to do. We think that creating biodiversity around our vineyards is just part and parcel of owning vineyards and managing them responsibly. We didn't know when we got there that could include a threatened species. But once we found out, then we needed to we weren't confused about what we wanted to do. We wanted to continue to do the rehabilitation, but we knew we needed some protection against the downside of the Endangered Species Act.
And how did you get that protection? Did you negotiate an agreement?
We got an agreement. We went to work with Environmental Defense, a fellow named Michael Bean, who helped us, who really became the matchmaker for us and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, to strike a deal that said we would guarantee that the population of red-legged frogs that were there when we got there was always going to be there. That turned out to be zero on this little creek. And that if they did come there and we accidentally killed one, that we would be protected from any fines or felonies or those sorts of things. And in exchange for that, we would actively work to make sure that they could live there. It's a signed agreement based mostly on trust. It goes on for 35 years, and it's the right thing for us to be doing. It's working great.
And has it forced you to change the way you do business in any way?
Well, we're learning how to plant willows and oak trees. That's one of the things we're learning about. We're discovering how to plant to rehabilitate the habitat for other native plants. So it's expanding our view of what our business is. It's giving us some challenges that we hadn't. Again, we, as you said in the beginning, we hadn't thought that this was going to be part of our business. But mm-hmm. But it's all going very well.
Now, I take it, you know, call me a cynic, but I'm willing to bet that red-legged frogs do not eat grapes.
No, they don't. Their legs are just a little too short. It's a little too hard to get up to the grapevine. So obviously they weren't ever going to be a threat for us in the vineyard. We do have animals out there that eat grapes, deer and wild pigs and stuff, and we exclude those with fences. But grape frogs are not the problem out there for us in terms of losing any grapes.
Robert Levine, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Robert Levine is Director of Grower Relations for the Robert Mondavi Wine Company, and he joined us from his office in San Luis Obispo, California. And John Nielsen, is the kind of arrangement that he's talking about, this agreement, what he says, you know, is it's written down but pretty much on trust, is that something that's proving useful? Are those kinds of deals being struck?
Yes. There are many of those kinds of agreements. Most of them, or many of them, put together with the help of Michael Bean over at Environmental Defense. They are scattered around the country. I can give you some examples. There's a whole bunch, about 100,000 acres of private forest land in Georgia that's been enrolled in a safe harbor agreement to preserve the red-cockaded woodpecker. There's at least one other vineyard in San Luis Obispo County in California that's doing a similar sort of arrangement to protect the least bells vireo and the red-legged frog. And there are a number of others I could go on. It would be my guess that there are as many of these little agreements as there are controversies concerning concerning whether or not endangered species should be around.
Let's get a caller back on the line. This is Eric, who's with us from Boise, Idaho.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Unfortunately, I have a good example of one way the Endangered Species Act is not working out so well, and that's with the issue of anadromous fish recovery. Anadromous fish are salmon that are spawned in mountain lakes and streams and rivers in Idaho and Washington and Oregon. They migrate out to the ocean, go far north as Alaska, and then return to the same streams and lakes as their birthplace to spawn again. The problem we had with that in the Pacific Northwest is the Bureau of Reclamation and Army Corps of Engineers built dams on these rivers up until the 1970s, and we've seen our native stocks plummet to near extinction with some particular genetic strains. And it's an incredibly complex recovery process because you have entire economies tied to the water that we use for irrigation and recreation out here and so forth. And I was just wondering if your guest could address salmon recovery a little bit.
John Nielsen, this is another of the more contentious areas, certainly.
Salmon is the mother of all contentious areas, or at least complicated endangered species issues. I was out there 10 years ago with Howard Burke as we did a 6-part series on the decline of wild salmon in the Pacific Northwest, which caused all the member stations in areas that didn't have a lot of running streams to complain. But what we found was that, of course, the major problem seemed to be the giant slabs of concrete across the major rivers, but there were problems of fishermen taking the fish out of the water when they were in the ocean. There were hatchery problems.
For farmed salmon.
Yeah, for farmed salmon. And the best sort of lowdown explanation of the biggest problem came from an executive at an aluminum company who said that he knew the perfect way to solve the salmon problem is that was just go door to door and tell every third person they had to leave the Northwest. I'm not saying it has to be done that way, but that is an immensely complicated issue. And the other factor, of course, is that we don't know enough yet about why anadromous fish, like salmon, do what they do, which makes it hard to know exactly what to save. And
throw in Native American rights in there, and you can imagine the difficulty.
Yeah, you don't just throw them in either.
Yeah, okay.
They're there.
Eric, thank you for pointing out the problem. Appreciate the phone call.
Certainly. Thank you very much, Neil.
We're talking about 30 years after the Endangered Species Act, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. A four-inched feathered animal has been the focus of business for the Central Texas Cattlemen's Association. The black-capped vireo is on the endangered species list, and joining us now is Steve Manning, a fifth-generation cattle rancher, project coordinator for the Leon River Restoration Project. He's with us from his office in Gatesville, Texas. Good of you to be with us today.
Thanks, Neil. Glad to be here.
Texans and cattlemen are both known to be independent types. So how did the Cattlemen's Association get involved in helping the black-capped vireo?
Well, our organization, the Central Texas Cattlemen's Association, is made up of families, ranching families, that once owned the land where Fort Hood, Texas now sits. And so we've had the grazing lease with the Army at Fort Hood for about 50 years. And we've, you know, obviously had a relationship with the federal government that goes back a long ways. Most ranchers in Texas, of course, Texas is nearly all privately owned, and so not too many of those kind of relationships out there.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Well, the Endangered Species Act, when it began to impact the Army at Fort Hood, and they began to react to try to find ways to work with this black-capped vireo, which is one of the listed species they have, it began to impact our ability to graze that land. And so we had to come up with some fairly progressive ways to be able to stay in business out there. So that's how we got into this.
So what'd you do?
Well, one of the problems with black-capped vireo, the two main reasons for the listing were, of course, loss of habitat, which is just about any listed species. And then the other one was the parasitism by the brown-headed cowbird. Of course, cowbirds are attracted to cattle, which was the reason folks were taking a negative look at cattle grazing on Fort Hood. Fort Hood had a cowbird trapping program where they were providing protection for these endangered species by trapping these cowbirds, but they had only been able to be successful on Fort Hood. And a lot of those cowbirds were traveling out across from private land and parasitizing nests on Fort Hood and going back. And as you pointed out, Texas people are pretty independent, and they just weren't anxious to get into a relationship with the federal government to, you know, let them put traps out. Well, we proposed that the Cattlemen Association put a group of partners together and begin doing trapping out on private land around Fort Hood. And so the Army took us up on that, and we put together a partnership with a number of NGOs at the very beginning, Texas Farm Bureau, Texas Southwestern Cattle Raisers, Texas Wildlife Association, our Central Texas Cattlemen Association, as well as Environmental Defense, Nature Conservancy, and Audubon, Texas. And as a group, we came up with funding sources and ideas, and we started a cowbird trapping program around Fort Hood. I think we put out 30 traps or 31 traps that first year, and it was very successful. Because of that, that gained the interest of some people down in Austin. This was in 1999. And our Commissioner of Agriculture, Susan Combs, and the some staff people for, at that time, Governor Bush, asked us to think about expanding that program, and so we did.
And it's working out okay?
We've now got over 400 traps running in 40 counties in Texas, running a cowbird trapping program under Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, one of the major success stories in this part of the nation.
Well, Steve Manning, congratulations and thanks very much.
You bet.
And Happy New Year to you.
Same to you.
Steve Manning, a member of the Central Texas Cattlemen's Association, project coordinator for the Leon River Restoration Project. John Nielsen, we just have a few seconds left, but as you suggest, there are a lot of success stories hidden amidst all the litigation.
Yes, and I should point out what they've replaced. And 10 years ago, there was a lot of talk about a phenomenon called shoot, shovel, and shut up, which was basically a way of getting rid of your problems without anybody knowing about it by destroying the habitat or otherwise dealing with your endangered species. And this is what these kind of private programs are created to avoid. And it sounds like in some cases it's happening.
We'll continue our conversation about saving endangered species and working cooperatively to do so when we come back from a short break. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is totn@npr.org. We'll also talk about the politics behind getting aid to victims of the Iranian earthquake, not always as simple as you might think. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're discussing creative solutions to the difficulties presented by endangered and threatened species, including the Endangered Species Act. Our guest here in Studio 3A is NPR's John Nielsen. And let's get some more callers on the line. And Captain Jeff joins
us.
Kansas
Howdy.
City, Missouri. Yes, you're on the line. Go ahead.
All righty. I'm on the beautiful Missouri River in the state of Missouri, and we have a humongous and long-lasting Endangered Species Act controversy going on here on the river. We have three endangered species, one fish and two birds. We've had things as entertaining as Senator Bond has attempted to use the budget process to outlaw even studying ways to reduce the destruction of these species, and big court battles last year. The Missouri River runs through 1/6 of the continental United States, or drains 1/6, and it's the longest river in the continent. And it's funny, unlike the anadromous fish in the Pacific Northwest, this is kind of an invisible controversy. But to those of us who live along and or earn our livings on the river, it's very important. I'm a ecotourism tour guide and riverboat operator, and to feel like you're in competition with the entire federal government makes it hard.
And you're the one who feels like you're in competition with the entire federal government.
Right, because the federal government has chosen to maintain this management of the river. And, you know, first Fish and Wildlife comes out and they say these species are going to go extinct. And so then the federal government says, well, we need somebody who's not so biased. So they gave it to the National Research Council of the National Science Foundations. And National Research Council said, well, these species are going to go extinct and you're destroying the economy of the river basin because it'd be worth more money as a tourism place. And they said, we need somebody else who's not so biased. And so they fired all the biologists who'd been working on the river project and gave it to two people from outside the basin, gave them 60 days to come up with a new biological opinion. Lo and behold, 2 weeks ago, they came out and they said, you got to do something about the way you're managing this river or all these creatures are going to go extinct. And so the federal government said, well, patooey, we don't want to hear it. The Corps of Engineers basically says that they're exempt from the Endangered Species Act.
And, Captain Jeff, I guess we should point out once more that you're involved in the tourism aspect of this.
I am. But, you know, it's interesting to note that actually I was involved in the river and the controversy before I became a tourboat operator. It's just that I was, people kept saying, take me out on the river, take me out on the river. And finally I said, sure, pay me.
Well, let's get a response. Thanks very much for the call, Captain Jeff.
Thank you.
And good luck to you.
Thank you.
John Nielsen, clearly these are complicated issues, and it does seem sometimes that people go shopping for the scientific opinion that they can sell to their constituents.
Yeah, but did they really say patooey? That's what I want to know.
I'd like to see that
actually,
in the language.
Actually, I want to say that that there are, you know, the issue of the quality of scientific work that is being done on to examine the status of endangered species, particularly lately, is a big one. There have been limitations put on the ability of certain groups to do research. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, in a couple of cases in the Northwest, has hired outside groups, not their own biologists, to do 5-year updates on important species, and it is definitely a rising issue. I shouldn't use that in connection with the Missouri River. I want to say that I know where the Missouri River is. I've heard of it, so that...
well, one of our larger ones, as was pointed out.
Yeah, but that is a very complicated battle, too, because I think... Isn't one of the issues whether or not you should lower the water table?
And I think, yes, and also where people can live, because if you're going to allow the river to run wild, then it's going to be flooding places where people currently live. So this is going to be a difficult situation no matter what happens, and it goes beyond endangered species. But let's talk just for a moment about politics and the Endangered Species Act itself. Its funding is a good deal lower than a lot of people would like and higher than others would like. The act itself can't be reauthorized. What's going on?
Well, it can be reauthorized. It was supposed to be reauthorized in 1992. It hasn't been reauthorized, and
I put that under the category of can't.
Yeah, okay.
Politically,
can't. Politically, it can't, and that has been because it's just been gridlock, a very polarized form of gridlock. There was an attempt during the Clinton administration to reauthorize the act in a number of relatively non-controversial ways that was backed by some environmental groups and a lot of congressmen who had reputation as good environmentalists, and they just had to drop it because it got controversial, because it changed the act, and the feeling was that any change in the act is a change for the worse. That was the feeling at the time, and so and on the other side of the debate, you have a lot of people who just want to throw the whole thing out, or at least change it very radically to make it much more voluntary, to add much more certainty to the lives of the regulated community, which sometimes translates into less certainty in the lives of the endangered species.
John Nielsen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
John Nielsen is NPR's environment correspondent. He was with us here in Studio 3A.